Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jim O'Brien. Thank you for allowing me to appear by telephone today. I have three principal points to emphasize before you today. It has to do with an inadequate review of the medical records. It also has to do with misapprehending those records so as to render an adverse credibility determination on Shalice Austin's testimony. And then there's an improper series of hypothetical questions that were posited to the vocational expert, which, again, was an issue in misapprehending the medical records. If the court has records or questions regarding the due process question, I'm certainly prepared to answer it, but I think that's been fully briefed. Shalice, there's dispute here, of course, but Shalice suffers from a 1.04 sub A spinal disorder listed impairment, or its equivalent under the step 3 sequential analysis. The error comes from the ALJ's failure to appreciate the medical records. I will point out to you at 107 and 108 of the record, which is the decision, that under finding of fact number 2, the ALJ makes a finding that the Shalice suffers from a degenerative disc disease, and then later on at 107 says, well, there's no evidence that she suffers from a degenerative disc disease. Now, there may be some confusion on the part of this ALJ. There are two different medical conditions. One is called a degenerative joint disease, and the other is degenerative disc disease, but they principally result in the same impact.
I'd like to clarify one thing. Are you arguing 1.04A or 1.04C?
1.40A.
04.
I think the issue of 1.04C was fully briefed as well, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead.
The details that are in the 1.4A show that osteoarthritis, which is also known as degenerative joint disease, degenerative disc disease, and facet arthritis, which is also known as osteoarthritis, are all medical conditions recognized in the listing itself. But when you look into the decision, you see that there is at finding of fact 2 and finding of fact 3, the judge appears to make a inconsistent statement regarding Shalice's degenerative joint disease. So we think that's just evidence alone of his inability to appreciate the medical conditions that he's been asked to evaluate.
Can I suggest that it would be more useful to talk about the medical evidence and credibility finding as it relates to the RFC.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Your
Honor?
Yes,
it would be more useful to me if you talked about the credibility finding and the medical evidence relating to the RFC rather than this question. We have very limited time is the problem.
Sure. Your Honor, I'd be happy to. The adverse credibility, I think this case is controlled by Brown versus Hunter. And I happen to have that available to me, where this court previously ruled that an ALJ does not provide specific, clear, and convincing reasons for rejecting a claimant's testimony by simply reciting the medical evidence in support of his or her residual functional capacity determination. That is precisely what happened here. In Brown versus Hunter, this court said the medical records were summarized in seven paragraphs. In eight paragraphs. In this particular case, the medical records were summarized in seven paragraphs, and they are in none of those summarizations does the ALJ tie anything that Shalice testified to a reason for finding the residual functional capacity. And that, of course, allowed him to find a less than fully credible testimony and not adhere to her testimony, such as muscle spasms. They were never brought a part of the residual functional capacity evaluation. Her inability to walk on uneven ground or at a reasonable pace even though, and I understand the regulations look for a impairment in walking, which requires that both upper extremities be involved, that does not say that the discussion at 1.04 on the meaningful evaluation of the inability to ambulate effectively is exclusively related only to exclusively related only to a two-handed or upper extremity.
I thought we were getting off 1.04, and we were going to talk about that regard to 1.04, whether
right. Yes, our principal issue here, Your Honor, is Shalise has a medical condition that is equivalent to a 1.04 with all of her testimony, none of which is identified as uncredible or incredible by this ALJ. And
right,
so,
suppose we disagreed with you and thought that it wasn't equivalent to 1.04, then what? Do you lose?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Your Honor.
Suppose we disagreed with you and thought that it wasn't, the evidence was not equivalent to 1.04A or 1.04C. Do you lose then?
No, because...
No, you don't.
We
so why don't we talk about what happens if we don't agree with you on 1.04?
Because the... and my request then would go to the ALJ's review of Shalise's testimony. And the Shalise's testimony... this is again back to Brown versus Hunter, and Shalise's testimony was not evaluated. No, there is no comparison in the decision for between Shalise's testimony and the determination of the residual functional capacity that was ultimately identified by this ALJ.
Mr. Brown, he did talk. I think earlier you said he just basically relied on them and just recounted the medical evidence. But he did talk also about her daily activities, right? I mean, he did.
Yes.
So what about
none of those daily activities? If I may, Your Honor, none of those daily activities actually showed how he compared them with some other evidence. In other words, there is no comparison about when Shalise testifies that when she went through the home, she sometimes has to lean against the wall or take a break or sit down. None of that testimony is considered. When she testified to vacuuming or mopping floors, the fact that she has to take an hour break in order to clean a 10-foot by 12-foot surface area, that's not considered. Now, he was free, if he wanted to find that was not believable. But he didn't actually discuss it. He didn't actually use the language of Brown versus Hunter, which is to say you've got to do something to tie each of your findings and link it to some testimony as not believable.
Don't the Rollins and Birch cases say that an ALJ can consider in assessing the credibility of a claimant, particularly one where the ALJ thinks that the objective medical evidence doesn't support the extent of the claimed symptoms? Don't those cases say that you can consider the extent of the daily activities and the inconsistency with the claimed disability?
But that puts us, the answer is yes, Your Honor, but that puts this court in the position of having to speculate as to what the ALJ meant. And this court will not speculate if it's not actually set forth in the decision that is made.
I'd like to reserve time. You have about a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would reserve the rest of my time then.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Fritz.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Frederick Fritz here for the Commissioner. I would like to specifically address appellant's claim that the ALJ improperly evaluated testimony contrary to the Brown case. This case is distinguishable from Brown because the ALJ provided multiple specific inconsistencies in Austin's testimony. He directly addresses what she testifies to then notes continual improvement through therapy and other traditional medical treatment. And he does also list several objective pieces of evidence that are inconsistent with her claims of total disability, as well as on 109, he specifically addresses the inconsistencies with her activities of daily living.
Now, can I ask one question? The ALJ says two things, and I've seen this in other opinions, but they don't seem very consistent to me. He says, on the one hand, that after careful consideration, he finds that the claimant's medically terminable impairments could reasonably be expected to cause the alleged symptoms. Then he says later that basically her alleged symptoms are not consistent with medical evidence. How can both of those things be true?
Well, Austin has a back impairment. It has been diagnosed by doctors. It exists as one of her impairments. It could reasonably cause the limitations that she has alleged. However, the medical evidence simply does not support the extent to which she alleges that her symptoms exist. We have the activities, we have the medical improvement, physical therapy, home exercise, traditional treatment, all resolved the back pain she originally felt from her initial injury. So much so that she went several years without any medical treatment at all. The record is void of any medical opinion.
She also said she was homeless for a while. It could be a connection between those two. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, even excluding the absence of medical treatment, the record is absent of any providers corroborating the extent of her allegations. In fact, it's the complete opposite. All of the opinions we have suggest that she is capable of much more than her allegations. They both state agency doctors say she's capable of medium work, which suggests 25 pounds occasionally, and 25 pounds normally, and 50 pounds occasionally. Even immediately after her injury, when she was evaluated by a disability doctor, she was only found to be 2% impaired, and this was immediately after the injury. She was found to be able to lift up to 60 pounds. So this is inconsistent with any notion that she meets a listing. That simply lacks evidence at this point. But to your questions about testimony, the ALJ specifically shows how some testimony is inconsistent with multiple elements of the record. And in regard to the listings, the record simply just does not provide the evidence to satisfy the elements. Listings are the highest standard. The case is over if appellant meets the listing. And here, appellant would like to focus on specific medical evidence, but easily understood portions of the listing are simply not met. 104A requires that Austin lose motor ability and sensation, but doctors have regularly reported normal gait, ability to ambulate effectively. She's able to care for six children, three of her own.
That part, I must say that I job on. She went into great detail about the fact that she children were presumably not being neglected, but that she was having a lot of help from them, that she rested a lot, that she had to sit down a lot, that she had to lie down a lot, take care of children. doesn't tell you a lot that she had six children, and that they not being neglected, as to how much physical energy she actually had. People in wheelchairs take care of children.
That is true, Your Honor. But in this particular instance, she had three children of her own and three children of her boyfriend. Her boyfriend's children were 6, 5, and 1 year old. I mean, it takes a significant amount of energy to care for children of that age, even if she had some degree of help from children that are slightly older. You know, she had the kids with her so much so that...
Can I interrupt? It seems like we've lost Judge Van Dyke. I don't know if you see him. I don't see him anymore.
Oh, I don't either. He must have the same computer issue I do. This whole system has its limitations.
I don't know if whoever's in charge of the IT feed in Portland can try and reconnect him.
Sam, can you see what you can do?
Yes, I'm going to reach out to him right now. I need him to reconnect. I don't have the ability to just connect directly to him.
And my problem is not something Sam can help with. Peter just cuts in.
Judge Berzon, you're cutting in and out.
I'm sorry. I have to sit close to the computer to be heard. What I was saying was that my computer problem is not one that Sam could deal with, because it is the computer just shutting down, and that may be his problem too.
Yeah, can you find me? Looks like he's rejoining now.
Okay, good.
Judge Van Dyke, can you hear us?
All right, I'm back. My whole computer locked up. I'm sorry. I was able to hear because my clerks are screening it. So I heard what you're saying, but mercifully, I didn't have any questions to ask you, Mr. Fripps, so you can continue. Sorry about that, judges.
Okay. Do any of your honors have any additional questions?
I do not.
No.
Well, as the commissioner notes, the ALJ's testimony evaluation was specific and clearly showed inconsistencies. The ALJ's evaluation of the listings was reasonable, and the commissioner asks that you show deference to the reasonable findings and find that the decision was supported by substantial evidence.
Did the ALJ ask her? So he seemed to have put a lot of stock in the fact that she took care of his children. She testified in great detail about how she had to stop when she was cleaning and shopping and so on. She doesn't really say anything specifically about watching the children the rest of the time, and she wasn't really asked, right?
Yeah. If you look to the record, it appears that she brought the children to doctor's appointments, which would suggest that she had the children so much so that there was no release to even leave them at home to go to medical appointments.
I thought she said she had help doing that. Is that wrong? I thought she said her boyfriend did it with her.
So looking at... So looking at page record site 336, they note, and it's others just like this, that the kids were at the doctor's appointments with her when she was there. But yes, the appellant's ability to care for the children is only one of the factors that was considered in finding that her impairments were inconsistent with the record. We have her ability to ambulate effectively, seen by multiple providers, and objective evidence, the lack of evidence for a significant period, the multiple opinions that suggest that she is capable of much more than alleged. And the ALJ's RFC is actually more restrictive than any medical opinion in the record. So ALJ gave deference to her allegations that she was more limited than the objective evidence appeared to show. Well, thank you. I would like to forfeit the remainder of my time.
Well, 28 seconds. Okay, Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have two responses to the commissioner's position. One is that this ALJ never incorporated any of the testimony that was provided by Shalise into a question to the vocational expert. I understand that he's free to disregard that part of the testimony that he doesn't believe, but apparently it wasn't entirely rejected testimony, and he never incorporated any of that evidence into any of the hypotheticals that were provided. He just went to an RFC hypothetical, and we think that was error by this ALJ. And that is what I believe that Brown versus Hunter stands for. You have to, an ALJ is required to tie the testimony of disbelief.
Mr. O'Brien, can you give us a specific example or two of what you're referring to when something from the claimant that the ALJ didn't reject but did not include in the RFC hypothetical but should have?
Shalise testified at hearing that she had difficulty with sleeping. She testified she had ongoing muscle spasms, which incidentally were a part of that objective medical record. She testified to symptoms of radiculopathy running down her left leg and buttock. None of that was incorporated in any of the RFCs or any of the questions, hypothetical questions. And yet I think this court is left then to speculate as to what it was the ALJ thought might have been a reason to disbelieve her, because it's not specifically provided for in the decision, which is, in my view, the whole thrust behind Brown versus Hunter. With that, I thank the court. If there are other questions, please feel free to inquire.
Thank you very much. The case of Austin versus Saul is submitted, and we will take a short break. And then we will come and hear the Emmer case.